A reading from Luke. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the feast according to the custom. After the feast was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But they, Mary and Joseph, were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they traveled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their friends and relatives. And when they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." "Why were you searching for me?" Jesus asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and humans. The word of the Lord. Two stories. Both are about families. A mother, a father, a young son. Both are set, at least in part, in a house of worship, a place of prayer and instruction and spiritual community where the family regularly attended. Both are snapshots of transitional moments, perhaps pivotal moments, not only in the characters' lives, but in a much broader context. The first story, to me, is one of the most moving, heartbreaking stories in all of Scripture. In the passage Bill read earlier, we find the boy Samuel, not still a child, but not quite a man, ministering before the Lord, essentially a priest in training, in Israel's most important house of worship at the time, the tabernacle at Shiloh. And we see his parents visiting him there, as they do regularly, once a year. And we read that his mom gives him a little robe. Doesn't that kind of break your heart? That she'd made for him, as she does each year. And the chief priest blesses the parents, as he does each year. And then the parents go back home, and Samuel stays. Without context, this carefully cropped snapshot would be heartbreaking enough, but if we pull back just a bit, we find that the reason the boy Samuel lives at the tabernacle and serves there year-round as a sort of priest in training is because his mother Hannah had been barren. She couldn't get pregnant. And like so many women in Scripture and in many cultures today, she had been scorned, stigmatized, cruelly mocked for years, as if there were something wrong with her, as if she'd been cursed by God for years. And we read that finally one day she couldn't take it anymore. She even stopped eating. The text says that in bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow saying, O Lord of hosts, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life. If we've never felt such anguish, perhaps we may not completely understand bargaining, negotiating, trying to make a deal with God. In time, Hannah got pregnant. Was it her faith? Was it because of her fervent prayer? Was it her willingness to sacrifice a normal motherhood and family life? Was it even a miracle? Well, these are good questions and worth exploring, but perhaps not today. Perhaps what we should focus on today is simply that Hannah kept her promise. And this is just as significant. When Hannah told her husband, Elkanah, about her promise, and by the way, she didn't exactly run this by him. Okay, she just told him. She broke the cardinal rule of marriage and child rearing. But Elkanah said, okay. He deferred. For whatever reason, he let her make the call. Do what seems best to you, he says. And as soon as Samuel was weaned, his parents journeyed to Shiloh, took him to the tabernacle, left him in the priest's care, and went back home. Which brings us back to our snapshot of this non-traditional family that sees each other once a year. And as strange as this arrangement may be, as much ambivalence as we may feel about it, somehow we get the sense that there's a lot of love there. There must be. Somehow Samuel knows he hasn't been abandoned. He knows he's special and valued and loved. His mom makes him a little robe every year, just a little bigger than last year's. His dad comes along, holds his mom's hand, lets her do most of the talking. There's a lot of love there in this snapshot moment in the tabernacle of the Lord. And the text says that the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with God and people. If we could see just outside the crop marks of the story, just a little farther down the road, we'd see the boy Samuel become an extraordinary leader, a prophet who spoke truth to power, who stood up to corruption, who anointed kings, who presided over perhaps the most significant period of transition in the history of Israel. Mostly behind the scenes, the power behind the power. But that's not in this snapshot. We only see a boy and his parents in church and lots of love. And the caption reads, "Growing in stature." I'm not exactly sure what that phrase means. It means a lot more than physical growth, I'm sure. Maybe it's what happens when you know somatically, integrally, and sometimes in spite of your own circumstances, that you are special and valued and loved. It's what happens when you get a sense of who you are and where you're going and what you're capable of. It's a quiet confidence that makes you stand just a little taller without even realizing it. It's backbone with humility. And people see that. They respect it. They're inspired by it. Which brings us to our second story. Again, a family, a mother, a father, a young son. Again, a house of worship, a place of prayer and instruction and spiritual community. Again, a snapshot of a transitional moment, a pivotal moment, not only in the characters' lives, but in a much broader context. But before we take a look at this story, it bears mentioning that today is the sixth day of Christmas. Six geese a-laying. And the last time y'all were here, the baby Jesus was just getting born. And now it's 12 years later. And some of y'all have been sitting there patiently, but admit it, thinking, what the heck does any of this have to do with Christmas? I know that because preachers can read minds. It's a spiritual gift. When I sent Lee my bulletin materials, I'd only requested one Christmas hymn, and she sent me back an email that said, a howl has gone up. I get it. I wish we could linger just a bit longer in the wonder and mystery and peace of Christmas. Unfortunately, a long time ago, the lectionary put-togetherers decided that in year C, if we were ever going to get through Luke, we had to keep it moving. So, you know, Luke is long. So Christmas Eve, you get swaddling clothes and shepherds and angels and Mary pondering all of these things in your heart. And the following Sunday, Jesus is 12. So I feel you, but maybe there's a lesson in there. In fact, maybe that's the lesson for today. Maybe the lesson is just like the boy Samuel, just like the 12-year-old Jesus, just like both their families. We are all always in transition. And maybe it's precisely in the midst of these transitions that God gives us opportunities to grow in stature. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The story about Jesus' parents discovering that he's missing and frantically searching for him, only to find him days later back in Jerusalem in the temple, sitting with teachers, listening, asking questions, sharing his thoughts. This is the only story about Jesus in any of the Gospels that occurs between infancy and age 30. So it's pretty significant. And I think that what's most significant about this story is how real it is, and therefore how relatable. I promised myself I wouldn't mention the movie Home Alone, like hordes of fellow preachers at this precise moment. But I'm breaking my promise only to say that this is emphatically not a case of bad parenting. If you hear nothing else from today's sermon, please take that away. And on the other hand, it is emphatically not a case of a rebellious, strong-willed preteen. It's much more complicated and much more simple. It's just life. Jesus was 12. Mary was in her mid-20s at most. Jesus was a good kid. Mary and Joseph were good parents. It happened. Things happen. What's important in this story isn't the circumstances of how Jesus came to be lost. What's important is what happens when he's found. And the first thing that happens is that Mary just about clobbers Jesus in the temple. This isn't the same 14-year-old virgin, meek and mild, that we encountered a few days ago on Christmas Eve. This is Mom Mary. And I just feel like, you know, she was probably really good at it. Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been looking all over for you. I mean, right? Note, too, that Joseph went to the Elkanah school of fathering. He's standing there, doesn't even mention him. He's got his hands in his pockets. He's kind of rocking back and forth on his heels. But at least he's there. And the first thing that Jesus says, indeed the first words he ever speaks in Luke, is a non-answer. In fact, it's another question. Why were you searching for me? Didn't you know I had to be in my Father's house? You know, let's not do what a lot of folks do. Let's not try to clean this up, okay? Let's not try to make excuses or rationalize or overanalyze this. It wasn't as ugly as it could have been, but it wasn't pretty. Jesus was so excited about this movement toward being taken seriously as an adult in his own right that he couldn't possibly understand or appreciate his parents' sense of terror at having lost him. At the same time that Mary and Joseph were so shocked that Jesus didn't even bother to tell them that he was leaving the caravan and, what, hitchhiking, I guess, all the way back to Jerusalem, that they couldn't possibly understand or appreciate his sense of pride and fulfillment and coming of age. It's an important time for Jesus. And they missed each other. Not because they were bad people, but because they were human. And again, maybe that's precisely the point. Because even in the midst of this palpable tension and a long, probably very quiet road trip back to Nazareth, Luke slips in a little nugget of profound grace. He says that when they got back home, do you remember this? Jesus was obedient to his parents. And that Mary not only let go of her anger, but began to treasure all of these things in her heart, including what she'd witnessed at the temple. And Luke says that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor of God and people, just like Samuel. Luke doesn't spell it out, but somehow, at some point, there's recognition. Softening, reconciliation. We get the sense that there's a lot of love there. There must be. Jesus knows he's special and valued and loved. And because of that knowledge, he can begin the process of differentiation and self-actualization that every young man and young woman must go through to become their truest selves. And this is the snapshot. A pivotal moment in Jesus' life and his parents' life to prepare them all for what lay ahead. And a subtle shift in family dynamics. If we could see just outside the crop marks, just a little farther down the road, we'd see the boy, Jesus, become an extraordinary leader, teacher, healer, who spoke truth to power, called out hypocrisy, who could have been a king but chose instead to be a servant, an advocate for the despised, the rejected, the unloved. But that's not in this snapshot. We see only a boy and his parents in church and lots of love. And the caption reads, "Growing in stature." Not exactly sure what it means. I know it's more than physical growth. Maybe it's what happens when you know somatically, integrally, and sometimes in spite of the circumstances that you're faced with, that you are special and valued and loved. It's a quiet confidence that makes you stand just a little taller without realizing it. It's backbone with humility. And people, they see that. They respect it. They're inspired by it. You know, maybe Luke included this story to emphasize this mind-blowing concept of the incarnation. This affirmation of the holiness of humanness. Immediately after the Christ event, the Christmas story, this testimony that God relates to us even in our inattentiveness and insensitivity, even in our panic and denial, even in our shame and self-justification. This extraordinary good news that growth most often is in the context of learning to navigate life's tensions, struggles, transitions. Imperfectly. And throughout life. Children, parents, families. If you'll permit me to be very personal here. Roy and Edna gave so many people in my family and perhaps in this church opportunities to grow in stature. They took people into their home at transitional times in their life, in times of heartbreak, of struggle, of addiction. And they loved them. Not perfectly, but faithfully. You could stay with them as long as you wanted. They never charged rent, but they had a box in the closet. And when you got paid, you put 10% of your check in the box. And that belonged to God. Morningside got most of that 10%, but once in a while, something else might come up. Red Cross, Easter Seals, somebody hungry. Roy and Edna made a difference, even in their own transitions. Even when their son died of cancer, and their grandson. Even when one eventually lost the other. Even when they went through their own dark, dark nights of the soul, asking the hardest questions of all. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Still, they grew ever stronger in stature. And you know, I have no doubt that this house of worship, this place of prayer and instruction and spiritual community, this tabernacle, this temple, our Father's house, I have no doubt that you had something to do with that. There's a lot of love here. So after all these years, I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you. In her new book, Michelle Obama writes, "Becoming isn't about arriving somewhere or achieving a certain aim. I see it instead as forward motion, a means of evolving, a way to reach continuously to a better self. The journey doesn't end. And there's power in allowing yourself to be known and heard, in owning your own unique story, in using your own authentic voice. And there's grace in being willing to know and hear others. This, for me, is how we become."